three orders sort of changed the dynamic in terms of labor and federal contracting a little bit. And the first executive order provides that the costs of activities undertaken by companies to either persuade employees not to join a union or to support employees joining a union are now to be unallowable under cost reimbursement type contracting. So those costs that a company would potentially incur in you know, providing materials about saying why you should or shouldn't join a union will no longer be allowable costs under a cost reimbursement contract.
And so you can't support and you can't go out against.
Yes, exactly. You know, and what that really does is it sort of shifts those costs. And you were mentioning the difference between fixed price costs and cost reimbursement type contracts.
Yeah, I don't think most people really get the difference and why one would choose one over the other.
Sure. And just to finish, I'll explain that, and then I'll. But first, let me finish this thought.
Sure.
With regard to the executive order with regard to unallowable costs, what that sort of does is basically say cost reimbursement contracts verboten these type of costs. Companies are still going to incur those type of costs, and you'll sort of see a shift that those costs will result in higher prices potentially, or additional costs and factored into the prices under firm fixed price contracts. Now, just briefly, as I was listening to your question, what's the difference between firm fixed price and cost reimbursement? Let me address that. Firm fixed price contract is as it sounds. It's a price certain to do a job. For example, you know, if you say I need someone to build a road for me or build a new bridge, you know, and theoretically the government asks for a firm fixed price, the contractors have to come in and propose that firm fixed price, and the risk is on the contractor to perform at the price of proposed once the contract is awarded. The theory behind firm fixed price contract is through competition, contractors come in, whatever their, service they're providing or product they're providing, they provide a firm fixed price. The risk is on them. There's less risk on the government. The idea is that leads through competition in the firm fixed price. The government is protected. Cost reimbursement contracts are typically used in more uncertain situations like development contracts, typically a lot of DOD development of weapon systems. And under those contracts, the risk is shifted to a certain degree, recognizing the risk of development and that the government agrees to pay the allowable costs incurred in performance of the contract. So, and the way that works is a offeror or a contractor will come in and say, here's my estimate of how much it's going to cost to develop this system and ultimately deliver it to the government. There's a whole set of rules and regulations on tracking those costs and preparing the estimate and providing it to the government for evaluation. And then once the contract is awarded, the government is obligated to reimburse those costs consistent with the allowability rules and the cost accounting standards. So the risk is, in a certain sense, is shifted to the government to reimburse those costs. You know, in a certain sense, it gets to a point regardless of success in the program because there is uncertainty whether it's going to succeed or not. So, and I think that's a lot of the concern that you see reflected on the Hill about, the use of cost reimbursement contracts. Does that shift too much of the risk?
There's just a lot more gray in there.
Does it shift too much of the risk to the government?
To the government, right.
On the flip side of it, though, from the private sector's perspective, there is risk there, and there's risk to them, and it's an uncertainty in the development effort. And in order to actually accomplish these things, the view of doing a cost reimbursement contract provides that flexibility in an uncertain environment. I mean, you don't go and try to develop, a major weapon system on a firm fixed price basis.
Right.
That's a prescription, in my view, for disaster.
Right. We want to jump back to the labor laws because some of these provisions are kind of unusual, and we were a little bit, we were sort of talking about them and wondering how the procurement law would actually support the executive order. How does that work?
Okay, well, you know, there's two other ones. You know, one of them is sort of a basic. It deals with notification of employee rights under federal labor laws, and that's, you know, providing notices with regard to employees' right to organize and unionize. It's sort of the flip side of what the previous administration did with in terms of providing notices that you don't have to join a union and you don't have to pay union dues. And that's, you know, that's just, I think, sort of, as you one would expect, goes with the parties and their different perspective on these things. But the most and more interesting one, I think the one you're referring to, is this executive order that deals with incumbent contract employees and the right of first refusal. And that executive order requires a new service contract clause mandating that, you know, you have that service employees under current federal contracts will have the right of first refusal for employment in the, you know, when a successor contract is awarded. So that means folks who are not, you know, essentially offered a job by the incumbent has lost. Those folks who are working on the government side or working on that contract must be offered a job by the awardee or the new successor contractor. And it also flows down to subcontracts as well. And it raises a number of interesting sort of questions on how the dynamic, how it's going to work. And your point about how it's going to work is the devil's in the details. And there's going to have to be FAR rules developed and implementation of a FAR clause. And also the Secretary of Labor, the Department of Labor, is going to issue the you know, rules governing enforcement and review of this particular provisioning, ensuring compliance. And it mirrors sort of the Service Contract Act.
And the issue here is you can be fined, possibly, if you don't comply.
Fined, debarred.
Right.
They could take all, you know, various types of sanctions to be further developed when the Secretary of Labor issues the regulations. But, you know, from a procurement perspective, in my view, it raises some interesting questions. Will this limit or hinder the government's ability to differentiate between offerors and competitive procurements if there's a de facto standard that, you know, a group of employees who may not go with the incumbent if they lose are automatically become, you know, the service employees or are at least have to be offered jobs under the awardee's contract? How does that impact the evaluation of proposals? How does that impact the evaluation of past performance, which is such a concern? I mean, the past performance is of the incumbent is intrinsic to the people he has or she has doing the job. And, you know, so in trying to, and those folks may end up, you know, having to be offered jobs under the by the successor contractor. So how do you differentiate in terms of past performance?